Welcome to The Aging Scientist, focusing on all things science and aging. I'm Clarissa Giebel, and I'm a researcher at the University of Liverpool. Launching a brand new season, this season 7 explores Australian aged and dementia care. From my recent travels to Australia, thanks to the Wellcome Trust, I went to see Sydney, Melbourne, and Adelaide and met some fantastic researchers in the field. Whilst Australia is quite similar to European systems, there are also significant differences, especially in how older adults and those with dementia and their carers are cared for and supported. So in this season, I'm speaking to some of those many experts about their work and experiences of the Australian system. In today's first episode, I'm joined by three brilliant minds, Katya Nambis, Darshini Eitan, and Kasia Lyon. Dr. Katya Nambis is a postdoctoral research fellow and study coordinator in the Centre for Healthy Brain Aging at the University of New South Wales. Broadly, her research focuses on modifiable lifestyle factors associated with increased dementia risk, with an emphasis on the utility of subjective reports of cognitive and functional decline. Dr. Eitan is the deputy head of the Health and Social Care Unit at Monash University. Her research focuses on the care of older people, particularly those living with dementia, in hospitals, aged care, and the community. She also has projects examining dementia prevention interventions and the implementation of emerging diagnostics for dementia. And last but not least, Dr. Kasia Lyon is a research fellow at Griffith University. Her research interests cover areas of quality of life and well-being of older people, people with dementia and their care partners, especially by improving care and access to services. Her recent project is looking into links between social isolation, loneliness and stigma in older people and those diagnosed with dementia. So welcome all. Great to see you again after my Australia travels.
Great to be here. Hello.
Great to see
Thank you
you.
for having us.
Yes. And just for our listeners to make you aware, there's a severe time zone difference. So it's morning for me and it's evening for those ladies over in Australia. So kudos to you for making it at 8 p.m. your time. Thank you very much.
Think that
So,
in Australia we are in two different time zones.
yes, and you also have a very funny half an hour time zone difference between Melbourne and
And
Adelaide.
Adelaide, yes.
That was quite funny to see that on my phone when I landed. I was like, what? Does that exist? Half an hour? Oh, that's great. So, I'm mindful that probably very few of the listeners of this podcast will know about the Australian system. And before I came to Australia, I know only a little bit about how the system works in Australia. And so maybe to start us off, for our listeners, could you explain the system of how older people and how people living with dementia can try and access care? Dash, do you want to maybe kick us off?
Well, I can start off, and I might start with the point of diagnosis, maybe. And so it is quite a process, I guess, and not always a straightforward process. So in Australia, on average, it can take, between 3 to 5 years to get a diagnosis of dementia, depending on how people are presenting and the symptoms. But typically what needs to happen is that someone will go to their general practitioner or their primary care practitioner and talk about the fact that they have memory problems. And so then that practitioner, that doctor, needs to then provide a referral for that person to then get a specialist assessment. And so that might be to a geriatrician, it might be to a neurologist, might be to a psychiatrist. So there's quite a few different specialties that can kind of be involved in the diagnosis process. They might go to what we call memory clinics here. And so they do a whole host, they've got a multidisciplinary team who can do a whole host of assessments. But I think the interesting thing, and what I've been struck with my research and talking to people who've gone through this diagnosis process, is, for example, if you don't have the typical symptoms of dementia, it can be really hard to convince your GP that you have dementia. They might diagnose you with something like depression or something totally different, or just say, oh, that's part of, you're stressed. I don't know, Katia, if you've got anything to add with that.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what I was thinking too. I mean, it, speaking with, a woman that I work closely with who's living with dementia, and she's got frontal temporal dementia, which is not those classic kind of amnestic symptoms. And, she was sort of just entirely dismissed by many people. And even now that she has a diagnosis, she says, they'll say kind of in a cavalier way, like, oh, how's the memory thing going? And yeah, so I think that's exactly right. If it's not that typical forgetting, names and objects type thing, then it's hard to find the diagnosis and then the post-diagnostic support.
Yes, and I think that, people who don't have Alzheimer's disease, and also if you've got young onset, really hard, I think, to get a diagnosis. But the post-diagnosis support is like no almost non-existent. And I find it amazing because I was talking to some people with lived experience recently, and a few of them have got cancer as well. And they said, when I got diagnosed with cancer, I was linked in with a person like a caseworker, a navigator who helped me navigate the system, linked me in with all of these services. Yet for some reason with dementia, we kind of are like, here you go, you've got a diagnosis of dementia. The memory clinics are not funded to do ongoing support and follow up. So they basically are like, off you go, here's some information about dementia, leaflets, good luck. And that's it.
It's very similar in the UK. We've recently done a study funded by the Alzheimer's Society comparing the Dutch and the English system. And I mean, we know that after diagnosis, it's a postcode lottery often, and if you have a carer and all these different barriers. But the care navigators, they do exist in England in different pockets and in different facilities and organizations, but people don't know about them. Whereas in the Netherlands, it seems that they're much more widely known. And they really help to facilitate that link to services after a diagnosis and be that one contact person. So, yeah, it's interesting that, again, it's similar in Australia, that that does not unfortunately exist. So, I've heard as well when I was over that accessing support in the care system. So, is it right that people get an allocated pot of funds if they have dementia, and then they themselves have to split this into what type of care would I like to receive, and they have to manage all of these things. Is that correct?
So I would start with saying that the services and how they are funded, the whole scheme or approach is so complicated. I think everyone struggles to get their head around, and only those people who are managing all those assessments and really are deep into the social work and helping people in those services and accessing it, they have a pretty good understanding. The rest of us, I think, we kind of know what's around and how it should be accessed, but it's really hard to navigate. And the moment when you get diagnosed with dementia, I feel like a lot of people don't know where to start and how to even look for it, because the packages you started talking about, Clarissa, they are related to aged care. So people, older people can access them. And mostly it's related to how independent they are. So the lower level of the package, it's more money, but it's also more care needed for them. On top of those packages, there are also some separate funding for care partners, family members who are providing care. And from what I learned, and again, I think Brisbane in Queensland, we are quite different in the way services can work towards comparing to Sydney or Melbourne. So from what I heard from care providers here is that they quite often utilize the caregiver funds towards the daycare services or daycare centers. So it's more treated as a respite for caregivers rather than delivering services to people with dementia. And that can impact, I think, the perception of those services, that they are not necessarily dedicated to people with dementia, but more towards caregivers. And the Then we have people with young onset dementia who are not qualifying at all for those services for older people. So the way they can access support is National Disability Scheme, NDIS, which is another very formal process to go through and trying to get support.
Horrendous, especially if you have cognitive deficits, it's already difficult to navigate things and just going through the process of what do I have? Do I have dementia? Do I have this? Do I have that? And then having to change the systems of support. No, you don't go through the aged care system. You go through, it's really difficult, isn't it?
It's really difficult. And I think also, sorry, go.
I was just going to say that there's sort of website that's, you know, like My Age Care, and it's just, you know, just like we've got MyGov and all of these things in Australia, and it's just like so ridiculously hard to navigate. And it's this portal that, like, even if you're not living with cognitive impairment or are quite familiar with navigating, like, these government websites, which are not at all intuitive, you know, it's still tricky. And so then there's this like other kind of gatekeeper thing where you've got to go onto this website, try to figure out what's going on with that, navigating, you know, it's just, yeah, it's pretty challenging.
Yeah, it's really challenging. And like, I think one of the things I'm also struck by is for the packages, you know, the assessment process can take a little while, and then learning and waiting to hear what package level you qualify can then take a little while. And then by the time you've qualified for that, your needs may have changed. And so it's just this complicated mess. So I do feel like we could be 100% doing better. And I think the other thing to note is that 2 out of 3 people living with dementia in Australia do live in the community. So they do rely on these packages. They're not, the majority are not living in residential aged care. So we do need to make this system, I feel, a bit better.
And that's important, isn't it? Because, I mean, when you speak to people with dementia, well, I suppose even when we think about, ooh, what would happen if we were to have dementia, we'd love to live in our own home, wouldn't we? And not necessarily in residential aged care. We'd love to be where we're comfortable and where we know everything. So we need to support people living at home much better and easier.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So that's a little snapshot of the Australian system, but that'll weave through all the questions I've got lined up for you guys anyways. But Kasia, let's start with you and your work. So we've worked together on an international COVID study, not knowing each other, just contacting one another. Was it social media or email or something? We found out about the work together. We started doing a 5-country research, which was really interesting, with Poland, Italy, and India as well. And then we first met a few weeks ago in person, which was interesting as well. It took, what, 2 years, 2.5 years? So what do you think, looking at the research that we've done and looking at all the research that you've done yourself as well, what do you think have been kind of the key findings for you comparing the Australian situation during the pandemic and since with other countries?
I think for myself, the most, I think, striking and surprising was how similar we were in terms of the effects of pandemic in Australia comparing to other countries. Because from all different perspectives, Australia looked like this great country with no COVID at all. And even our lockdowns at the very beginning, and that's when we conducted our study straight after the first lockdowns. So people knew there was not many cases of COVID in the community. Despite all the restrictions, we felt quite safe from the very beginning with closed borders. But surprisingly, when we started talking to people, they were still feeling afraid, isolated. The services were terribly impacted. And in our research, we did not look specifically into how people accessed services rather than just trying to compare them pre and during the pandemic. But I think because we were doing qualitative, so we were asking questions, people just started speaking openly about how challenging the care system is to navigate in Australia. And it created this one big theme within our results that the system was hard and challenging before the pandemic. And then when the COVID-19 hit and all the restrictions were implemented, it just went as a nightmare because people couldn't access services. They didn't know if they could access them or not, if the carer was still coming into their house or not. It was such a big misinformation and the differences between different services at the same time. So I think for me, the most was like the mess and how it impacted, despite thinking that in Australia, we were quite free of COVID and quite safe, and despite Victoria and all the lockdowns they had. But majority of us felt quite safe and we didn't feel much of the virus until late last year when everything started. So I think...
I know it's featured heavily abroad in the media as well when, I don't know, was it Melbourne sometimes having 5 cases and complete lockdown? We're not going out, lockdown. Everyone's at home. Mm-hmm. So
we experienced that in Brisbane, like 1 case, 5 cases, we need to have a lockdown for 5 days, 8 days, depends on how severe it was.
So, I mean, we've all... In all countries, I suppose, across the world now, we've witnessed the impacts of COVID. There's been so much research done, which is fantastic that so much research has been done, and also comparative research of how the pandemic has impacted people with dementia, their carers, but also the care workforce, because we shouldn't forget them. They've really done a fantastic job, often without guidance. But so you just mentioned that you witnessed in your interviews that people were saying, well, even before the pandemic, the system was messed up. It didn't work. It didn't function well for us and for others. Do you think that any learnings now for the Australian system moving out of the pandemic, we're not out yet, but moving gradually out, and any policy recommendations so that the system can change or is changing?
I think there is plenty of learnings, and I would just start with the very simple ones. I think just improving the communication, that was one of the biggest issues on many levels, that the government didn't communicate clearly to people what's available, what's impacted, what's not. Then the service providers, they weren't clear, for example, within residential care, of the level of lockdowns, if there were visits allowed, how people could communicate. So I think... a simple thing like communication, which can be improved, is one of the biggest learnings from our study. And the other one is value of staff, because we know from our findings that those people who were even in the lockdown in facilities, if they had access to an engaged staff member who could assist them with using WhatsApp, Zoom, whatever video communicator they were using, families still felt connected to a degree. But we know that in Australia, and it's a current big issue, how to pay better for aged care workforce. So that's kind of in progress, and we hopefully see some improvements sooner than later.
So because of your background, I'm going to ask you as well, how do you think the Australian system compares to the Polish system, Kasia, because you said you only moved to Australia a few years ago?
I think it's a totally different system on different in different aspects. I'll start with the culture. So in Australia, it's more obvious that you're using services than for people in Poland. And we can say that in Australia, people 2 out of 3 people with dementia still live within community. But I think people and families are more open to use services and help. When in Poland, it's rather obvious that when someone has dementia, or it's more common to say it's memory problems, which are quite normal still, That's how Polish people still think quite regularly, that it's not dementia, it's just memory problems, it's aging. So older people are just at home. And with the diagnosis there, you quite often search for diagnosis quite late when people are really in advanced stage and the family kind of struggles to provide care. And people with mild to probably moderate dementia, they don't even realize there is an issue there because it's so considered normal. And I think the availability in services, despite all the challenges in Australia, is still much bigger. Poland has very limited services dedicated to people with dementia. So there are some daycare places when people can join activities during the day, but they are mostly directed to either older people or people with intellectual disabilities. So people with dementia joining them there. In terms of residential care, there are places mostly located within bigger cities, but it's hard to get there. And it's, again, not dementia specific, more for older people with some physical challenges rather than people with dementia. And so the staff is also not very well trained in dealing and providing care.
Yeah, that came out in our comparison, didn't it, as well, that there's quite a bit of stigma still in Poland and people tend to care for people with dementia in their own home and family as opposed to outside. So
we need to provide care for our parents, grandparents.
Yeah.
I think there's some advantages because we feel like they are still part of our families. And in this way, I think we have more respect to older people. And I think in Australia, sometimes we struggle with valuing older people. And that's maybe where the challenges in aged care starts.
Mm-hmm. So Katja, you've done some COVID research as well, and you've got lots of data that you're juggling with, isn't it, for the mass? And we've had a chat about that. So do you want to tell us a bit about your data and any COVID research that you've been involved with?
Yeah, sure. So I was the former coordinator of the Memory and Aging Study, or the MASS study. And it's a big longitudinal study. It started back in 2005 and we wrapped up in December 2020. It's like quite a year to wrap up in, right? And during that time, you know, I thought we've got to get some data on this, you know, so we drafted up a questionnaire. And we ended up sending it out, and this was during our first wave of COVID, right? So that first lockdown, which was so, so strict and so, so sudden, even though we didn't have a lot of cases. So it was a really interesting time to collect data. And I think what's interesting from our data set, so it's not huge, it's about 350 people, but it's across three longitudinal studies. So we've got people ranging from 65 up to 103, and we've got quite a lot of longitudinal data, at least on some of those people. So you can really kind of ask these cool, you know, retrospective questions. So are there things about a person's social health or physical health or mental health that are sort of predicting who, you know, was, we were calling it resilience, I don't know, for lack of a better term, who kind of dealt with the pandemic better at that stage. And so we then later have a colleague in Germany, and we sent out the questionnaire to him, and he collected a whole bunch of data during their second wave. And we've yet to compare it, but I think it's going to be super interesting because, you know, one set of questionnaires was collected during this time of extreme lockdown and a social isolation and government mandated and all of this insanity, but no real cases in Australia, whereas the German data was collected during, you know, the height of Delta. So they had the lockdown plus all of, you know, the deaths and hospitalizations. And so we haven't looked at it yet, I must admit, but it's there, it's cleaned, it's ready to dig into. Yeah.
Yeah, we need to follow up on that email as well, Katja. Yeah.
I'm waiting.
Little reminder. So, but you say it's a small cohort with about 350, but let's let's bear in mind, collecting cohort and data and setting up cohorts is incredibly difficult, and getting that retention of people to, you said 15 years, 2005 to 20.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That is an achievement. So I'm sure there'll be some really interesting stuff coming out of that. And I mean, I've seen what data you collected. So it's huge.
Yeah. MASS is super comprehensive. And, you know, that's the strength of it, is that we've got, you know, a complete neuropsych battery for most waves. We've got blood data. We've got some imaging data. We've got physical data, self-report data, informant report data. You know, of course, had it been ongoing still and we weren't already planning to wrap up in December, we would have loved to collect more COVID data to see how that was sort of changing as the case numbers actually did come to Australia and the lockdown sort of started to ease. But yeah, at this point, we have this kind of really rich retrospective data that we can look at. You know, did it change the way that people kind of navigated the pandemic? And so we did a few like in-class analyses, but you know, there were some people who really were impacted in terms of healthcare and support and physical health, mental health, et cetera, but reported feeling pretty okay about the situation. And then there were people who were saying, you know, this is the worst thing that's ever happened, and then, you know, had no impact to their day-to-day life, so to speak, at least that they were. So, you know, why were some people, again, more resilient to the effects of the lockdown and the uncertainty and the isolation than others? Hopefully we can follow up with that. There's lots of cool questions we can be asking. I'm so excited to hear that you like were talking to other Australian researchers about COVID, and give me their names immediately.
So you mentioned as well that you're now setting up MASS 2, is that right? So a brand new cohort with brand new participants, is that right?
That's right, yeah. So a big undertaking. So we're aiming to look at what we call age cohort effects. So the idea really is, you know, we've written extensively on all of these things that are risk factors and protective factors for older Australians, air quotes included. But that's really based on a cohort that's quite old now. So the MASS cohort is about 88, maybe even a bit older on average now. Yeah. So, you know, people who were born in 1910 had an entirely different childhood experience and different education opportunities and occupation opportunities and even social norms around drinking and smoking and, you know, all these things than somebody born in the 1930s, their children. And it's kind of strange to make policy recommendations for older Australians, again, air quotes, you know, age 65 and up, based on data from, you know, this first cohort. So we're refreshing. We're going to try to recruit from all of the same local government areas, as they're called in Australia, and same age bracket of 70 to 90. We're same test plus, you know, a few things that we didn't know about. So audiometry, retinal scanning, microbiome, a few things, you know, yeah. So like all the things that we had no idea impacted brain aging back in the day. And, you know, fingers crossed. We have a fairly good retention in MASS over time. Like you have to imagine that people, we started with 1,037 people. We ended up with about 300 in the MASS study. So those other numbers were coming from other CHIVA studies for the COVID queue. It's such an undertaking. We're asking them to do so much, and like you just can't believe how keen and willing and amazing these people are. So it's not easy, but yeah, fingers crossed we'll get some really cool data and we can kind of look across the two cohorts.
Definitely. And it's, yeah, it's right. People who are born in 1910 have a completely different upbringing, right? And they age probably very differently than someone who's born in 1950s or 1960s. Right. And we will age differently than to my grandmother. So
yes. And it's because of everything, you know, all these world events that have shaped us and these really like pivotal moments in our lives. And even stuff like, you know, if we looked at our 70-year-old versus our 90-year-old participants at intake, you know, especially with women, the opportunities that were available to them in terms of the occupations that they were reporting, education, you know, all of these things. So it'll be really cool to see what comes out of this and if we can actually, similarities, differences. extra
And
information.
it's so interesting because, you know, you hear about people who've lived through the world wars, right? And they do particular things because that was their experience, have particular kind of behaviors because of that. That was their experience. And I think about then the people who will be born after this pandemic, who might then of us, when we're older, be like, oh yeah, that's because they lived through that pandemic. You know, like we do weird things
Self-serving.
because, oh yeah, that COVID pandemic. So who
Exactly.
knows how it's all going to play out? It's going to be interesting.
Well, and actually, when I'm talking to Clarissa, go and give me some COVID questions because obviously this is now a major part of these new cohort experiences, having lived through a pandemic
Yeah.
and navigating new technology to talk to family and order groceries online and all these things. So yeah, it's gonna be really cool. And yeah, I always joke that I wonder if my kids will like look at each other and be like, oh, my mom used to drive a car back in the day. Can you believe it? You know, things are just gonna be not that I have children, you
One
have the dog
day.
in the background, Katya. I've
I do
seen.
have a dog.
Constantly surprised at my driving.
So Daj, you've been very patient. So listening to all of the other people and their
Sorry.
fantastic research. No, it's great. But it's great to come to you now because your work looks a lot at implementation, doesn't it? So how can real life changes be made based on the research evidence, and how does it actually work in practice? So what are you working on at the moment, looking at implementation?
It's a lot, and I have really enjoyed actually hearing from everyone today because it's like, yes, this is like, I just feel like, you know, when all the stars align and you kind of are like, oh, you're finding that too, or yes, it's like, you know, affirming and having those conversations. So it's been fantastic. But I do work in quite a few different settings, but I guess the main settings I work in is hospitals and residential aged care. And particularly during COVID, I was kicked out of the hospitals, but I wasn't kicked out of residential aged care. So I think that's an interesting element in and of itself. Like all research had to stop. I couldn't do data collection on the wards. I wasn't allowed to send volunteers in. So my main project that I'm funded through a fellowship to do is to kind of train up volunteers to support people who have dementia in hospital to provide that kind of psychosocial support. But that all stopped and I can't do that because of COVID. But I have been doing a lot with residential aged care. And I think Kasia mentioned this. One of the biggest things I have learned through implementation over the last couple of years is that when systems were struggling beforehand, add in something like a pandemic, those things are absolutely magnified. And in particular, the care workforce has been absolutely magnified, and they are a core component of implementation. And so, anything that we develop in the research world, whether it's being like right now, I'm working on a massive center of research excellence, which is looking at how do we take blood biomarkers and cognitive assessments into memory clinics. I still have to come back and think, well, where's the capacity in the workforce to make this happen? It's not enough to just have like the intervention looking pretty and having all of these different things. It's like, how do we equip the system? How do we equip the workforce? And then also, how do we, you know, empower patients around some of this? And so I think implementation has been really hard, but it's always been hard. But I feel like COVID has also made it more obvious where why it's hard, and the fact that we often have a very optimistic view of stuff we develop in the research world as to whether or not it's relevant, meaningful, and translatable into actual practice. Like, why would someone want to do this? Like, I keep coming back to, why does the sector need this? Why do the partners need this? Do they even care? Do they have the resources, time, energy, capacity? And I sometimes think, you know, they're bombarded by us as researchers, particularly implementation scientists, because we're like, oh, we need a setting to put this into. And I feel like, you know, occasionally we might tip them over the edge when they're like, I just don't have time for this. Go away. So it's tricky.
So do you involve people with lived experiences and the care workforce as kind of key stakeholders as part of your work and in co-production workshops, et cetera, to kind of generate those ideas?
Absolutely. And so generally, all of the projects that we do, have a run-in pre-implementation period, which might take a year or 18 months, where we literally sit and talk to people and say, hey, these are some of our ideas. But it's kind of almost like sometimes we don't even tell them what our ideas are. We say, for example, that dementia diagnosis journey, we just started with tell me your diagnosis story. And we started with them like mapping that out as a river of life exercise. So people were telling us using this imagery of a river as to when their river was smooth, when their river was, you know, murky and there was rocks, when there were bridges, and so that we could map the care pathways across this. And then it's, we then are now talking to clinicians and practice people that we might want to implement it into their kind of setting. And we're showing them the patient river and then asking them to tell us about their journey so that then when we go, okay, our ideas are blood biomarkers, our ideas are medical imaging, our ideas are cognitive assessments, it's in that context. And I am so, so thankful for our, in Australia, we call them consumers, which I hate that word, but our patient advisors or our people with lived experience, living experience, expertise, and the time and the frankness that they, you know, tell us information and say, no, you really need to understand this, and spending time talking to people about that. Because I think traditionally, particularly from ethics perspectives, they're like, you can't ask that of people with cognitive impairment. You know, they don't have the capacity to tell you these things. Yes, they do. And so I kind of feel like we need to myth bust that and say, ask the questions, just ask them, see what happens, and then go from there. So yeah, we spend probably a year doing pre-implementation before we implement anything.
So that's really interesting, because I had this precise chat at the AAG conference with a couple of researchers on public and patient involvement, that there seems to be a bit of murkiness, blurriness in the Australian ethics system sometimes, in terms of, do you need ethics for co-production and public involvement? Because you don't,
and people don't get that.
That's interesting.
And so there's a lot of education, and like that's one of the other hats I do wear, is patient and public involvement, and you know, training researchers and health professionals in how to do that, and also our people with lived experience. But that's one of the big things. It's like, no, you're not collecting data from them about their own experience. You're getting their advice. They're your consultants. Like, they're the people telling you what needs to be happening and how. And then you go to ethics with that designed. And I don't feel like it's always sunk in, but I think in particular in the area of dementia, people are like, well, what are we going to ask them, and how are we going to do that, and how are they going to put input into that? So it's interesting. But we have 10 advisors on ours, and they have like totally changed the way we're thinking about our project, how we did data collection, how we're doing recruitment. It's amazing.
I know, it's really good. We have a lot of people with dementia, a lot of unpaid carers, but also charity providers and care professionals on our teams, and generally in the Liverpool Dementia Forum, etc. And you can really tell, we as researchers, we know the methods. We know what's kind of the latest research, et cetera. We know how to run analysis, but we need people that actually live through it and provide the care to really flag up, no, this is actually an issue when I go to the memory clinic, or this is an issue when I provide care there, or all these things. We wouldn't know them. So it's.
And I think exactly as you said, like in doing this work, it's talking to the people receiving care, but also delivering care, and different levels of people delivering care. Because, you know, so I made the mistake very early on in doing some of this early work, only speaking to senior people or managers, and they had very different experience than if you're talking to the direct care worker, who was like, actually, no, that might be what people think is happening, but this is the reality on the ground. And really knowing that up front, super important.
Absolutely. I could go on for hours. So I'm mindful it's 9 o'clock over there. So we need to wrap it up. Don't want to get you on this too late. But I've got a final question for all of you. Big one. So with your different backgrounds and experiences, you know a lot about dementia care in Australia and your implementation work, Dash. Would you think is one of the biggest challenges in dementia in Australia? And how do you think this could be addressed, or is it just too difficult to do so? Kasia, what do you think?
Why do we start with me? I think one big issue we touched and spoke is the communication and the services, how they can be easier accessible. And we know there is a bit of work going on in the government now. So hopefully we'll see some good changes. So from my background and my particular interest, I think understanding the stigmatization around dementia is a big issue, because in different countries, it looks differently and people can understand being stigmatized and how it impacts them in a very different ways. And there hasn't been much done in Australia in terms of listening to people with dementia, how they experience living with dementia, what do they think about having dementia, what does it mean for them, what it makes them to do. And for me, a big challenge is also reaching to those people we quite often don't see in research. I think that's a challenge everywhere, that we usually get the same participants for different studies because they are kind of more visible, more keen to take part. So I think I took a bit of a bumpy road, and I try to access people who don't usually use internet. I'm reaching to some services in the Sunshine Coast to link me with people they supporting. So probably my recruitment will take a bit longer to hear from those people with dementia, but hopefully I'll get a good few people who haven't taken part in research previously. So hopefully you can hear from those people who are maybe more socially isolated or socially rejected, that they don't have this courage to go into the world and say, I'm a person living with dementia. I'm happy to tell you everything about it. Because I think those people who are not so brave, they can be more valuable for us as researchers as well.
Absolutely. So it's around stigma, but also increasing diversity in the research participants. But I think this also links in nicely to increasing diversity in our co-production work that we do, because we often find that there might be unpaid carers, for example, who are very confident and they can contribute a lot and they step forward. But it's then for us to support those that might feel not as confident or think, oh, it's a room full of academics, and let's support everyone to have that voice. So what about you, Katya? What do you think is one of the biggest challenges in Australia?
I am going to piggyback on Katya, because I really agree that there's, and it's going back to what Darsh was saying too, you know, there's just not a lot of involvement at more than a tokenistic level from, you know, people who are actually having like a lived experience of dementia. And especially, like I said, like these sort of more uncommon kinds of dementia, right? So young onset or frontotemporal or something that's not presenting as your like classic, you know, losing your memory, et cetera, et cetera. And I just think about, you know, the stigmas that are even embedded within researchers, for example. And, you know, for example, this idea that older people, especially with, you know, who are living with dementia, can't or won't use technology, right? That's absolutely not true. And in fact, a lot of them use it as a really kind of extended support system. And because of that, things that are available for other groups of people are not being developed for this population, you know? And so it's kind of like the research mind is even still put in that way and being biased. But also this idea of like, you can't ask that and you can't include that. And, you know, just like a quick little aside is we had asked a couple of people living with dementia to come to a first and second year medical student practical. And we did there's a show here called ABCs, You Can't Ask That. And so we did a live Q&A and we let the students ask that. You know what? Here you can ask that. And it was fabulous. And I will tell you what, both of the advocates reached out to us afterwards and said, please, can we do that again? That's so important. It was so fascinating to hear those kinds of questions and be raw and honest and like, speak to them now. And I think so even as researchers and lecturers and people designing policy, there's this idea that we should involve people who are having lived experiences, but not really kind of thing. So overcoming that and really having, going to coffee with them every day for months, like Darsh is saying, and talking about the plan before you even go to ethics, so it's really a whole involvement. And I think, beyond that, we've got problems like every other country in terms of access to assessments and post-diagnostic support and kind of educating the public about where to go and how to navigate these systems. But I think a lot of my work, is just about the subjective experience and trusting what a person's saying to you, putting some faith and merit in that, and involving them in the design and the output.
I echo that absolutely. Darsh, what about you?
I think the biggest challenge we face from a funding, like we see it at every level, we see it in the funding, we see it in the relational, we see it in the policy, we see it across the board, is that I don't feel like we value older people enough. And we kind of feel like, and we saw this with the COVID narrative, right? They're going to die anyway, so it doesn't matter. And it breaks my heart because I just sit there and think these people have lived lives, but they also deserve quality of life. They deserve quality of care, and they deserve, the best end. And I feel like we need to consistently research and think of, how do we translate our research into practice to make sure that happens, but it's not valued enough because, when we do health economics or we do all of these things, it's like years of life, there's not a lot left. And so we don't necessarily have these big bang numbers, like even with drugs for dementia, it's like, well, what is the impact in terms of years of life that their people are living and extending? It's not big, but that doesn't mean it's not important. And I feel like, we have a moral and ethical call to not give up in this space. And I'm just really hopeful that as, next generations come in, that this call gets louder and that governments listen more so that we can keep actually making this a funding priority.
And I mean, not everyone might be affected by that, but let's not forget I know people from work, I've got friends, their grandmas, grandpas, and they might be retired, but they care for for their grandkids so that their children can do the work or they do volunteering, and they're valuable members of society and they've contributed to society. So they should have as much respect as anyone. So, yes.
Yeah.
I think we should look into the awareness of what the productivity means as well. I think Australia or probably in some other Western countries, we are so much focused on how much you're delivering to the society. But then at the moment, maybe there is a time to take a break and just be rewarded for all your hard work and get those taxes you paid across the whole year. And in Australia, we are taxed quite heavily on everything. So let's get some money back into my own retirement and get the support I need to have this nice time as an older person, despite having dementia or other problems, which are more typical for older people.
So there's another topic emerging there, Kasia, for another podcast. Yes, Katya.
Yes, the stereotypes podcast.
Bring the group back together.
Ooh, I like that. I'm making notes of that.
Mythbusters and stereotypes.
And ageism.
Ageism, yes.
All of it. That's us. We're coming back.
Absolutely. You'll be invited back. Absolutely. Ooh. So thank you all. Oh, I see another member of the podcast team. What's your dog's name, Dash?
So she's called P. Dunkle. She's named after the cerebellar P. Dunkle in your brain because, we do brain research.
Yeah, you can tell we're like a virtual room full of scientists.
And he's named after Hermann von Ebbinghaus, who was the first experimental memory researcher.
That, I love that. Oh, my God, that's so good.
Right. So Thank you all. I'm now going to think of cat names because I really want to get a cat, how to scientifically name it. So thank you, Katya, Kasia and Dash. It's been fantastic talking to you and seeing you again after my trip. It's lovely seeing you again. So if you as listeners want to find out more about everyone's research and work, do take a look at the bio with links to their profiles. And for more discussions on the Australian aged care system and how it works in the land down under, have a listen to my next few podcast episodes. Goodbye, everyone.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for organizing. Great to meet you guys.